I guess everyone's here who wants to be here, and maybe some of you who don't, but we're going to start now. Is there anyone here who needs some help hearing?
Not yet, thank you.
Okay. You in the other room, would you start the tape, please? It's kind of a spooky feeling that someone's over there and hears that and goes click. I'm still Peter Nash, and this is the third of five sessions on biblical images of shalom. And what we're going to look at today are some of the impediments or roadblocks to shalom. What are the things that keep us from getting there? Some of them are things we can't do anything about, and others are things that we can. I think there are four basic roadblocks, three that can be handled with a simple thing called repentance or change of attitude or turning around, and one that cannot, one that requires a different sort of divine intervention. And I've listed them here on the board. We talked yesterday about divided loyalties. As long as a person divides his or her loyalties, there really isn't a possibility of shalom, either internally or externally within the community, either as a personal peace, an peaceness with oneself and family, or to be able to create it within the environment. When we run in several different directions, we tend not to get anything done well. If you've ever participated in one of those personal development seminars, the first thing they ask you is, what do you want to do? What's the one most important thing that you want to do with your life? And make sure you work at it some every day. Well, if we've got seven or eight most important things, or even three or four most important things, then we find ourselves in trouble. Diversification, we're told, is a good strategy for investments, but when it comes to worship, it's disastrous. And when it comes to organizing our lives, if we have several different things making claims on our lives, I find it impossible to work wholeheartedly for anything, especially when it's somebody else's justice, somebody else's well-being. The second one is related. They're all related, and so we do them all on the same day. Maybe the subtlest but most perverse, pervasive, maybe it's the most perverse too, judging from where it first gets mentioned in the Bible, of these divided loyalties is self-worship. We have a tendency as human beings to want to be like God, to want to be little gods, or maybe in the case of some of us, big gods. And that makes it, again, impossible for us to move toward anyone else's well-being, to move toward a state of wholeness, as long as we're confused as to who really makes security. We tend then, thinking that we can make security for ourselves and our loved ones, to try to accumulate things or knowledge, or faith in such a way as to protect ourselves, thereby turning just about anything we choose to work at into salvation by works rather than as a gift from God. I don't mean to suggest when you hear me talk negatively about the accumulation of things, I don't mean to suggest that God doesn't want us to be happy and comfortable. What I'm trying to say is that when that is the goal, rather than a side benefit, then we're putting our eggs in the wrong basket, to mix several different metaphors. Mm-hmm. The third listed on the board is individual freedom. This is a problem that wasn't even considered, if it was considered, it wasn't considered very frequently in the Hebrew Bible. The Israelites on either end of the power continuum had an assumption that what was good for the nation was good for the people, was good for the individuals. And one didn't have the option of doing something outside of that collective good. The typical response to such an action was that there's a great phrase that comes up, a passive form of the verb, which says, if confined to that, the largest concentric circle was the nation of Israel. In spite of the fact that there was a theme, there is a theme that runs throughout Hebrew scriptures that says, this is for all people, for the whole earth, not only for all the people of the earth, but for the earth itself. God is in relationship with all of creation. The Israelites were able, by necessity, to isolate it to their own nation, and they did so quite well, as we heard in Leviticus 19. This is a limitation to shalom, clearly. It means that anyone, were it not for Christ, it would mean that anyone who was not Jewish wasn't part of the picture. Fortunately, we have that, is there a lawyer in the house? Codicil? At the new part that makes exceptions in the new covenant that makes it a universal covenant, makes it clear that God is in relation with not only all human beings, but with all flesh and with the very creation itself. Now, there's an implicit imperialism, or I prefer to call it evangelism, in that statement, we have something to say to the whole of humankind and to all creation that needs to be heard. And some people are more comfortable than others with that. I'm pretty comfortable with the charge that we are to make disciples of all nations. I don't think we need to do it by the sword, however. Well, let's go back and look at some of the... are there questions before we go on, or comments? Let's look at some of the injunctions against these divided loyalties first, and we'll go through these in the sequence that they're on the board. Let's take a quick look at Genesis 1. This is not the oldest piece of literature in the Bible. Sometimes when we sit down to read the Bible, we want to do it the way it's, some people say, the way it was written. Well, this is, when we do that, we do it the way it was edited. But it is not by accident that it was set here first, in first place. What the priestly writers, the last ones that have a crack at editing the Hebrew Bible, wanted us to see was that God was in charge of everything, and intended for us to understand that God, the creator of the universe, was the one that we needed to pay attention to. One of the things that happens in this passage is the demythologization, or the re-mythologization, of the universe. The Mesopotamians and the Egyptians and the Canaanites and the Israelites believed, at least for a time, that the sun was a god. The word for sun in Hebrew is Shemesh. The name for one of the chief Akkadian gods and Babylonian gods is Shamash. Same Semitic root. The moon, Yareach, is known as Yarach, the moon god, also known in Akkadian as Sin. He was the chief god of Haran, a city that we'll hear about in just a minute. What happens when the priestly writers put this Hebrew version of the creation story in the first place in the Bible, it says, yes, we're related to the sun and the moon and the stars and the fish, the plants. The sun does tell you, the place of the sun in the sky does tell you about the seasons. And we know now that it does moderate and control the seasons. But it itself is not a deity. It doesn't do that of its own power. It does that through the power of the one who made it and who made you. So the sun is your partner in creation, not your lord in creation. The same is true of the moon, which we know has different pulls on different among us, both emotionally, physiologically, psychologically. They don't call them lunatics for nothing. And you can ask any nurse or doctor how many more people come into emergency rooms, how many people come into psychiatric units when the moon is full, because they do and have babies. The Israelites, the ancient Near Eastern folk, were not dumb. They knew this. They knew that the crazies acted a little more, were more likely to act crazy at this time, and that women were more likely to have babies, that the geography, the lakes themselves, if they were big enough, they changed. The tides were affected and are affected by the moon. And so the author here is telling us, no, these aren't gods. They do affect things, but they're not the ones in control. This stuff is all controlled by Yahweh, the one who created you and me, the one who made a covenant with us. So don't divide your loyalties there. The place where that most needed to be heard, remember that the Israelites were an agricultural society, and their nearest neighbors, the Canaanites, had this great agricultural god. The god who, like the seed, died and was resurrected, and that therefore brought forth the produce of the land. Baal, you'll hear him called. And when you read the prophets, boy, does he take a beating. The great story in 1 Kings 18, the great... in my classes, I call it the great Pillsbury pray-off, when Elijah prays in sort of against, and set up two altars, and 400 prophets of Baal pray and gash themselves, and he mocks them, and then he douses water on the altar, and then says a simple prayer, and fire comes down and consumes the offering. And then the Israelites, who have been really pretty, not only tempted, but pretty infatuated with this Baal, begin to think, well, maybe we do have the wrong God. But they're not quite convinced even at that point. But Baal takes a real beating, and there's a real need to make this point quite clear, that it's that the seasons are part of creation, not the prime mover. So don't dissipate your efforts by worshiping the cycles of the agricultural seasons, or the stock market is more the way we would go. I said a bull market or a bear market. Well, I'll just adjust my life according to that. Mm-hmm. Another place we get a fairly clear picture of how we can divide our loyalties without thinking of it, without realizing it, is when we look at Genesis 12, when Abram gets his call. In the first, I think, three verses there, while you're looking to that, while Abram is in Haran, Sin City, so to speak, Moon Town, where the god Sin is worshipped, And that's, yeah, it's a bad pun, and it's just unintentional that this God had this name. It was nothing like Chicago. Abraham, having moved from Ur down in Mesopotamia, up almost out of Mesopotamia to Haran, is called to leave first the big circle, his country, then the smaller circle, his family, which is sort of the ancient Near Eastern version of the safety net, those who would catch you and catch your family if you were to depart from the world suddenly. All kinds of obligations in all of the ancient Near Eastern cultures to take care of the widows and the orphans within your family, and if the family didn't do it, then the nation was supposed, the king was supposed to take care of it. But we see the best example of that in the story of Ruth, what the family obligation is to make sure that the family doesn't disappear from the face of the earth. And then his father's house, his father's home. So then we're down to a small, you know, the most basic what he's supposed to take care of. And he, even while he follows this command and eliminates those other loyalties, anything that would divide his loyalty or separate his loyalty from God, he does fulfill his obligation within the family to make sure that his nephew Lot is taken care of. He fulfills his obligation to his deceased brother and takes Lot along with him, which, depending on how you read the story, is one of the first conflicts, the first examples of the lack of shalom within the covenant people. Lot has to be sort of eliminated from his life before the story can move along, because the herdsmen of Lot and the herdsmen of Abraham got into a fight over water, which is what they used to always fight about over there. And so Lot went one way, and Abram went the other way. Genesis 15 we looked at yesterday. I told my wife last night if I ever wrote an article about these next few chapters, starting in 15, I would entitle it something like "Natural Childbirth is Not the Answer." Abraham did exactly what was natural. The first line was, with no descendants at that age, was that a trusted servant would inherit things, a faithful servant would inherit things. An Aramean named Eliezer. And God says, no, it's going to come forth from your seed. So Abraham says, well, hon, this is what God said, it must. And she says, well, take my maidservant Hagar. And that's the way it was done. I mean, we just go a little bit further, a few chapters down the road, and we see Jacob. Leah has children, Rachel doesn't. Rachel gives her maidservant. And then I talk about the Pillsbury birth off in the story where she has a son, and her maidservant has a son, and her maidservant has a son, until we've got all of the 12 sons of Jacob and one daughter that barely figures into the story. But the point here is, even the natural cycle of things is not reliable if it's not relied upon within the context of God making things possible. He went through what was the normal route in his day, and that still wasn't the way God was carrying the plan forward. Still wasn't the way God was making things whole. Is there a question?
Keep going. I'm just trying to grasp that.
Let me just see if I can say it another way. In his system, he trusted the system, which was take a concubine, a servant, and have offspring. That was the way to do things. If you're, because in the ancient Near East, it was always the woman who was barren. Men never had any problem with fertility.
It was the same in China, for instance. I mean, if the wife would not bear a child, the husband was supposed to take a second wife and bear a son. And the reason was that the son can only wipe the grave clean once a year. You have to have a male child. Otherwise you won't be at rest when you're in your grave.
Mm-hmm.
And it was completely acceptable. The first wife was still the boss. The second wife was still kowtowing to her. But there was nothing wrong by having two wives for that particular reason.
But in this case, the intent, the natural cycle was, it was not what was going to make shalom. It was not what's going to make Abraham whole. It was, in this case, the work, the very work of God, so that this woman who is this couple, which is well beyond childbearing years, is going to be blessed. Now, I have some questions about whether or not being blessed with a one-year-old in your 80s is a blessing, but they regard it as such, and it's presented as such in the text, and I'll accept their judgment. Pardon?
Hello, servants.
Yeah. Common, is it?
His way, God doing it his way, or is it something significant about family structure, or is it more just a matter of power? Let's do it my way, do it with your first life. Or is it challenging to structure?
The argument that I'm trying to make here is that what Abraham did was take a step back towards self-reliance, or I should say a step forward to self-reliance. I'm going to figure out how to make it all myself rather than stand in the promise that it was that it would come. And then Exodus 20, which we looked at yesterday, the first couple of verses, the 1 through 5, the very clear statement that you shall have a command that you shall have no other gods before me. Near Eastern scholars often translate this as you shall have no other gods in my presence. That is to mean that you'll have no other gods that you place on a par with me. There wasn't a problem so much with the idea that there was, that we acknowledge that other gods existed. That was very much a part of the ancient Near Eastern mindset. But what we had to understand is that there's one who's really in charge. And there's a great story in 1 Samuel 4, I think, when they come into Philistine territory, and for some reason, I forget what the sin is, that causes them to lose a battle, and the Ark of the Covenant is seized in the battle, and they drag it off, and they put it in the temple of Dagon, which means corn. one of the gods of Philistia, and every morning they wake up and Dagon is knocked over. One day he's knocked over and his arms are off, and the next day he's knocked over and his head is off, and they begin to get the picture that no other god is to be in the presence of the God who lives, whose presence is known in the Ark of the Covenant. I speak as if everyone here is a Lutheran. My forbearer, Martin Luther, reminds me that whatever I fear, love, and trust above all things is, in fact, my God. And this first commandment makes that makes clear to us that what we need to do is to fear, to give the respect that is due, to love and to trust our Creator above all things. And if we take even a part of our lives and move it over here and say, well, God doesn't really deal with this stuff, then we've divided our loyalties. It's not, and that's not encouraging you to abdicate your responsibilities. It's trying to get you to put them in, trying to get us to put them in relationship to God rather than outside of relationship to God. The culture allows us lots of covenants. I asked you yesterday to stop and think about where those covenants, those various covenants, cause conflicts for you from time to time. The contract that you have at work, the contract that you have with your spouse, the contracts that you have with your children to protect them and to raise, keep them safe. Those are the ones, those have conflicts enough built into them, depending on what your job is and what the requirements are of your time and your energy. And then there are but those are the ones that our society says are okay. You know, those three, you go ahead and make. You should make them. But they have enough. And then there are the ones outside. Well, we're not supposed to have more than one love interest at a time. But many of us do. No one in this room, but as a problem with this culture in general. When we do have families that break up and we remarry and find ourselves with two families, two sets of children, another one that our culture says is okay, but there are conflicts there of how do you spend time with two sets of children that don't live together. Those are the ones that are okay. There are other ones outside that we clearly say are not acceptable, but even the ones inside, when not brought into submission, into the first priority, the acknowledgement that it is God who makes all of these things, and all covenants are made within that. When someone said, you know, if we had orderly lives, if we led orderly lives, all of our contracts would be predicated on the primary contract. And I responded, yes, if we had orderly lives. But was that you who said that? Well, this is a plea for us to order our lives in the first commandment and the things that we've just looked at. As we talk about divided loyalties. When we talk about, are there questions or comments?
The only one thing I find here in Genesis 13, when Abraham and Lot are separating, the reason is that they had too many possessions to live together. The land would not accommodate them, so they have to split up.
Mm-hmm.
So there's almost the possessions that is the problem.
But there is a conflict between their herdsmen over the water rights. So you could certainly read it as an overabundance. I think I mentioned an interesting book called The Predicament of the Prosperous on the first day by Bruce Birch and Larry Rasmussen, and their first chapter is entitled Insurmountable Opportunities, which I always chuckle at when I think about it. Yes?
You were asked a question about what different covenants we live in. And yesterday, you know, when we think in terms of covenants, we were thinking of specific contracts and everything. But when we look at divided loyalties, your roadblocks here, then I can't help but think about, you know, how caught up people are in this country being consumers and that we think it's all right. There's no appreciable difference between the lifestyles of Christians in this country and other people. They didn't think we lived, you know, maybe better. You know, at least in the Lutheran Church, it's a pretty prosperous church. But when you look at it, that, you know, that people in this country are only 6% of the world's population, but we consume 40% of the world's resources, And it's clearly that everyone in the world can't participate when a group, you know, is that consumes that well. I see that we haven't worked out in our minds how we can have divided loyalties along there to the point where it's not even an issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't even think of, an interesting parallel to that, to go back to what I know more about, is that we like to think that there's a real difference between Israelites and Canaanites. And the text would make you believe that, you read the Hebrew Bible. But an archaeologist can't tell the difference. If you go into a Canaanite village or an Israelite village from the same period, the houses look the same. Worship spaces are very similar. They were one culture. And we are, as Christians, part of this American culture. And there are some, it's a tough question that we have to ask ourselves. How do you tell the difference when you walk into a Christian home from a non-Christian home? And yes, it's sort of an imperialistic, exclusive question, but is there something other than the cross on the door or the Bible on the shelf or the coffee table that, yes?
You mentioned a concern for evangelism. A resource tape a few months ago talked about the popularity of Islam and how they talk about three deities below Allah, and they're, I think they are money, wealth, and sex, something like that, and how they push their people to bring all of these deities under the one God.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying, we as Americans, the best evangelism would be to live out a lifestyle which would show that we don't worship these.
You're right. That we do put them in submission to the one God. Resource, you're talking about the ELCA tape series for pastors and professionals in ministry? Just so others know where they might find that if they wanted to hear that. That was one of the really amazing things I found living in Egypt, in Cairo. The absolute pervasiveness of the religion in their culture. And I went back and forth thinking, boy, that'd be great if Christianity had that sort of influence in the United States. That happened to be the time that Ayatollah Khomeini came to power in Iran, so I really flipped away from it in the final analysis. But it's everywhere. I mean, the cities stomp in a way that we don't stomp at Christmas time or Easter time, and takes heed of the religious call. One of the tenets of Islam is refraining from alcohol, and they enforce it legally in Egypt during the Ramadan, the fast season. And I look enough like an Egyptian that I had difficulty getting a beer, which is really sinful for a Lutheran. I had to show my blue passport before they'd serve me.
Excuse me, while we're talking about this.
While we're off the track?
I think a lot of this is this difference between Christians and non-Christians in terms of what you might find in their home. Is not some of that because the awareness is only now being talked about in terms of the things we heard yesterday in the discussion about exploiting the earth and that sort of thing. That's a relatively new bit of information to the general populace. There have been people who have been very interested in ecology for a long time, but for the most part, it's not been a mainstream issue.
Well,
I think in Southern California, one of the reasons it's really coming to the forefront now is we're looking at the finite resource of water, and that probably has brought the damage to the ecology closer to home than anything I know of in the last 20 years.
I don't know what you mean by just now. When I was in seminary from 75 to 79, my best friend, who is my best man, was from San Francisco. And I walked into the shower one day, and he was buck naked, lathered up. And I looked at him and said, Andy, what are you doing? You need water to take a shower. And he looked up and he said, oh, this was in September, so we'd just come back to school. I said, we don't ration water out here. So maybe it's becoming publicly aware in Southern California just now, but you were rationing water in San Francisco in 1976 or 77. So that's nearly 15 years that's been a problem, and it's not fixed yet because we've chosen not to fix it.
That's only a single issue, but I'm saying in terms of public awareness, there are still people, the businesses today still have a little median strip this wide and put 4,000 times as much water as they need on it, and I'm saying that we're still, as a population, generally not aware of the... When you come to Holden, you become very sensitized to it, as you do with other issues, but I think that it's difficult for a lot of people, mainstream people, to be aware of some of these differences that are obviously very important, because it's not talked about, it's not in the media. As I say, the water is now because we've got a current water shortage.
Yeah, and what I think will happen is that when the water problem gets solved, we buy water from someplace else, or there's a considerable snowfall or rainfall, so that for a season or two it dissipates, people will again overuse water, and what I'm arguing is that no, this information has been available to the general public, has been put before the general public over and over again, and when what we tend to do is pay attention to it when our shoes pinch. Yes.
I think that calls to mind the incredible power of these gods. It's not as though we can just sort of say, well, I think I'll decide that I will, from here on in, be my total loyalty to Yahweh. Because there's an addictive, powerful nature to wealth.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to hear about ecological issues because I can't drive my BMW at 80 miles an hour.
And look at the incredible resistance to my home state, to GM, which is my home state, to downsizing cars. I mean, we had in 73 and 75, was it? We had incredible lines for gasoline. And we still, in Michigan, didn't want to make smaller cars. And as soon as... we got some more control over those wild men and women over there in the Middle East, what do? We started making big cars again because we like the individual power on the highway. We do now, in part because the Japanese are making such better cars, continue to make small cars in joint ventures. But we're back making those big gas guzzlers because we can, or think we can. And think we can continue to do it.
And even for those of us who did buy smaller cars, what does it have to say about your first roadblock up there when the OPEC ministers could do what God couldn't?
Yeah.
Most of us that own smaller cars, it's not because we feel called to use less petroleum, it's because the price is now five times what it was 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's the other side of the question, is that thinking back to what the OPEC ministers did for us, how many of us have really changed our driving patterns in the last 15 years? Self-reliance. Was there another question or comment? Let's look at the beginning of the book of Ecclesiastes. Most of the things I've asked you to look at have come from the downside, the side of the people without authority trying to make things safe and survivable. And this makes this next passage a little more interesting. This wisdom is ascribed, this piece of wisdom literature is ascribed to Solomon. And the superscription says, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. So it's one of the kings of Judah. And since Solomon was such a wise guy, he gets the credit for the wisdom stuff in this book. In the book, collection of books called the Bible. And the first thing he says, as his sort of, in his sort of grand reflections on life, is uselessness of uselessness. All is useless. What advantage does a man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. There's an optimistic, they say this guy's so cynical, I say that's an optimistic comment. Change the context and you have a different statement. But focus is on that first part because it does set the tone for the book. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Pile it up. I mean, this guy had it all. If it is Solomon, 300 wives, 700 concubines, fortified cities of the north and the south and the west. No one could get at him without his control of the trade routes of the world. The ability to study everything there was to study in his day. And he tells us it doesn't make any difference. The piling it up is not the purpose. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow it may be all over. And Jesus picks up on that theme in the Gospel of Luke with the parable or the story of the man who had so much. He didn't know what to do with it. I'll tear down my barns and build new ones. And that night he hears, "You fool, this night your soul is required of you." So piling it up, making our own security just doesn't work. It's not a possibility, as much as we try, and as much as it looks like others have been able to do it. I've got to look this up and make sure what just popped into my head is actually where I think it is before I send you racing through your Bibles. Not where I thought it was. Any questions about that or comments about our desire to make ourselves self-reliant? Yes?
Well, I think that's what consumerism is, self-reliant. And that's what our society kind of bases itself on. It wants to be self-reliant. We don't put God first. And going back to Abraham, Sarah, that was a test of faith. God brought Isaac out of barrenness, and he always does in Genesis and Exodus things in a backwards way. He doesn't follow the common line. We as Americans follow the common line, but if we put God first, we'll find that God doesn't work in ways that we want him to. He works in his ways. Mm-hmm. And I really think that's the message that comes from Abraham, is that it isn't a divided line. Please, God has to come first in your life. And it's not easy to do, but that's the message that's there. Mm-hmm.
What's the first recorded sin according to the traditional scheme of things. Pardon? In eating of the apple and self-reliance. What is the serpent promise Eve? You will have knowledge and you will be like God. That's what we do when we try to be self-reliant. And this is a very difficult thing for us. And I would imagine even more so for you, as Americans, I would imagine even more so for you who live out here on the West Coast, especially in the Pacific Northwest, who are truly pioneer stock. I mean, for my, in my case it's a little different, but for most Midwesterners, the pioneer movement stopped 100 years ago. There's still a lot of people who have moved up here because it is sort of the last wilderness. It's sort of the edge of the frontier. And some of you have relatives who have moved even further up into that really crazy place called Alaska. But it's hard for Americans to hear because we think of ourselves as always able to make it by our wit and by the strength of our hands and our back.
But that's not what the Bible tells us. And if you study the Bible, you know, God starts even from the very beginning of Genesis to give power to the weak.
Mm-hmm.
Like Joseph, he's the youngest and oldest brother, and he gets all the power. He becomes the king.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like the message there over and over again.
Over and over again, the reversal, as you mentioned, the way that Isaac was conceived. If the Hebrew Bible tells you that a woman is barren, the next verse or the next chapter will tell you, and she conceived and bore a son. If the Old Testament gives you two sons or three sons, you can be sure that the firstborn, the one who's supposed to get the goods, isn't going to get them. It's constant stories of reversal. Individuality. This is the most problematic. Let me check my time here. I talk too much, and you let me, and my daughter suffered. I created an imbalance in Shalom yesterday. They didn't get through their movie, which they plan to show at 10. So they're going to finish it up today. This one's a tough one because our situation has changed so much. Most of us don't live in a situation where if I do something wrong, you will die. In most cases. Now, if I run my car through a stop sign and you have me coming through, then that may be the case. But if I don't worship on Sunday, if I just don't participate in the community, it's not going to have an effect on you for the most part. Holden makes that look very different. Everyone who doesn't create an excuse and staff works in all areas from high to low in terms of what the culture defines hierarchy. We're very concerned here about the whole community being participating in all levels. But that's not the way it works in most of American culture. You can drop out. You can avoid, you can grab and you don't not called into account in most cases for what other people don't have because of what you do have. And both ends of the power continuum in ancient Israel, being out of community meant being dead. And if you were out of the community and out of the community standards, if you weren't dead, because you endangered the community, they would make you dead. Let's look at Numbers. I mentioned before that a common theme in the laws is that one shall be cut off from his people. Numbers 15, I think it starts... around verse 30... sort of 29, you shall have one law for him who does anything unintentionally, for him who is a native among the sons of Israel, and for the alien who sojourns among them. But the person who does anything defiantly, whether he is a native or an alien, that one is blaspheming the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from his people. Because he has despised the word of the Lord and has broken his commandment, that person shall be cut off completely. His guilt shall be on him. And then in the 32, now while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering wood on the Sabbath day. And those who found him gathering wood brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation. And they put him in custody because it had not been declared what should be done to him. Then the Lord said to Moses, this man shall surely be put to death, and all the congregation shall stone him with stones outside of the camp. And of course, when you get a direct order like that, you follow through. If I buy beer on Sunday in Missouri, it doesn't bother anybody. Missouri, because they were one of the last states to do away with their blue laws, as I understand it, their Sunday laws. If I don't rest, it doesn't bother me. But in that culture, it made a difference. It put them all at jeopardy because it put the community out of relationship with Yahweh. Questions or comments? Let's move on then to the limited reach or the scope of shalom. As we ended yesterday, we read Leviticus 19, starting somewhere around verse 13, where it was very clear that the shalom, that the people you weren't supposed to steal from, the people you weren't supposed to bear false witness against, people you were not supposed to murder, were the people, the sons, and let's say the children of your people. It applied to the Israelites. So if it was a Canaanite or a Perizzite or a Hittite, well, that's another story. In fact, it was often necessary that those people, they needed to be driven into the sea, to borrow a phrase from another Semitic people. But we don't live by that part of the covenant anymore, thankfully. We live by a part of that codicil, that new part that says there aren't any limits to the community. Let me just tell you the story of one of the places where these concentric circles got too confusing, or at least for my mind, got too confusing, and where they really came into conflict. After the death of Saul, David was able to hold control of the southern part of the kingdom. He had a capital in Hebron, H-E-B-R-O-N, and ruled there for 7 years while he tried to figure out how to consolidate the power. Abner, Saul's general, with one of Saul's descendants, temporarily took power in the north and ruled for a brief period. And finally, Abner saw things were falling apart and came down to David and said, let's cut a deal. I can bring the northern kingdom, the northern portion of the kingdom, into your power. And David makes a covenant with him. Now, David has other covenants already. He has one in particular is with his general, Joab, who knows what's good for David politically better than David seems to know. Joab knows that Abner can't be trusted. Joab also knows that Abner was the one who killed his cousin. So David has a covenant with Abner, not with Abner. He has a covenant, previous covenant with Joab, and Joab has a previous covenant in his family to avenge by blood for blood. Someone in the family, a relative, has to go out and strike down the one who strikes down your relative. So a pretty messy situation. It looks sort of like a soap opera. So what does Joab do? He kills Abner, has him murdered. David's obligation under this covenant with Abner is to do away with Joab. who is his right-hand man, who knows what's better for him and the country better than he does, and who is his fighting and drinking buddy. So he puts off his obligation until he's on his deathbed. And then he finishes off his obligation to Abner because he knows that Joab is dangerous to his son Solomon. And so the last order, one of the last orders on his deathbed is that Joab be killed so he can't bother his son as he ascends to the throne. So all of these circles, David's big circle now with the whole nation, and Abner is included in that. David's circle with Joab, and finally, and Joab's circle with his family, which has been violated by Abner, and finally David's circle within his family, and his circle with the nation, come into conflict with each other at a variety of stages. And that's the kind of mess that we get into when we have lots of small circles and concentric circles and overlapping circles rather than the large circle that encompasses all of the circles, and that's the circle that we have in the New Covenant. Jesus makes it clear that this, yes, first of the lost sheep of Israel, at the early stages of his ministry, but at the end of the ministry, it's clearly for the whole of creation. And that's the benefit that we have and the obligation that we have. So that I can't say, had I been an Israelite, an Israelite in America, if you can mix that in your mind for a minute, I could have said, well, it's all right that my child goes to school where every schoolroom has an Apple computer because it's a blessing from God that I happen to live there. And if your child lives in a place where they don't really have enough paper and pencils and crayons so they can even learn to write properly, let alone become computer literate, well, that's my obligation is taken care of. But in this new covenant, in this large circle that encompasses all of creation, my response has to be as adamant for your child as it is for my own. That we can't have these bizarre discrepancies within states, within cities even, where one school will have everything it needs for education and another school has virtually nothing. I can't stand by and watch it. I can't divide my loyalties that way. I have to. One of the few have-tos of the gospel regard your child as important as mine.
Which brings you then to the garage sales, you know, where you sell all your surplus goodies that you have stored up in the attic for years to wring the last penny out of it instead of giving it to people who have no chair. I think the garage sale is one of the things you can really see how this old culture works. Wring the last penny out of it.
That's on a small scale, and if you look every May or June, you'll see that our government has a big garage sale. Northrop has a big garage sale. General Dynamics has a big garage sale. And what we don't sell to those places we promise not to sell arms, like South Africa, we sell to Israel or to China, and they turn around and sell them to South Africa or Libya. Not in the case of Israel, of course, but to those places we've pledged that our arms won't go. We've got to empty the room. If you can bring it, we can start with that question tomorrow, if you will, and then our kids will get to see the movie. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.